when it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain. I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
And I want to thank that fellow down under.
Fair shake of a
sauce
bottle, mate.
Hello there, Mark Kenny with Democracy Sausage from the Australian National University. Glad to be with you again. Thanks for joining us. I'm, of course, sitting in the studio with Dr. Maria Tafaga, political scientist with the School of Politics and International Relations. I'm going to say industrial relations.
My that would habit. Be a new change, yes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, haven't you heard about the restructure?
Secondary boycotts, yeah.
Yeah, that's right. 45D, was it, I think?
Exactly,
yeah.
Yes, yeah. Definitely.
Yes, of the Trade Practices Act. That just shows how what we've been reading in our earlier part of our lives. We're going to be talking about the referendum today, Maria, the looming referendum, the date about which is not, for which has not been set yet. So quite fascinating. We're going to be doing that with Matt Quartrup. He's a Coventry University academic, also a political scientist, I understand. That right, Matt?
Yes.
Yes. And he's a visiting fellow here at the Australian National University in the area of constitutional law. And he's widely regarded as a global expert on referendums, taking a great interest in referendums around the world, around the democratic world. And fortuitously, here in Australia, just as we're doing it. And we don't do it too often. I mean, it's 1999 was the last one we had here, Matt. And so you've picked a good year to be here looking at the phenomenon and witnessing how it goes.
Yes, and you used to do it quite a lot. And then it didn't always go to plan. And I suppose a politician's got their fingers burned a little bit and therefore they've dragged it out somewhat.
Yes, it's a tough mechanism. I think that's the truth of it. It's one that we know has not delivered the sort of results that the advocates of any particular question have necessarily wanted. We know that there's been 44 questions. I know people are sick of hearing these stats, but they're important. 44 questions that have been put in Australia's federated history. Only 8 of those have been supported. All 8 were the result of bipartisan support. Only 1 of the 8 came from a Labor government. That's tells you something perhaps about the importance of a Conservative government being behind them, or of the Conservative Party giving its support and therefore bringing people who have
something about the electorate as well.
Yeah, well, yeah. I think that's sort of what I'm saying though, that the electorate is reassured when the Conservative parties tend to be behind it as well. They find it because we've seen.
Well, often their proposals are more conservative and less transformational, and that kind of makes sense. Like, I think the last one to get up from the conservative side of politics was to essentially, you know, make the elections line up in 77 and to essentially ensure that people actually appoint a senator. You know better than me, Matt. Appoint a senator from the same party, because Joe Bjelke-Petersen and the New South Wales Premier, whose name I cannot remember, played funny buggers with the Whitlam government, which was one of the dominoes in place to produce the dismissal.
To produce this deadlock in the Senate.
That's
right. Which then led to the dismissal.
Exactly.
That's right. But there's a lot of things, there's a lot of myths about referendums, and I'm really glad to have you here, Matt, because you can talk about some of these things. The first one I want to go to is the double majority. And this isn't so much a myth, but it's often misspoken about. I've heard quite informed people say that you have to have a majority of votes in a majority of states and leave it at that. But it's actually you have to have a majority of votes and a majority of votes in a majority of states.
Yes, you have to have the double majority. Yes. And I think it would have been 13 that it would have passed rather than 8 if there'd been. So there's 5 that failed, that get a majority of the votes,
yeah,
but not a majority of the states. And a lot of people say that's the reason why, because in Australia, the institutional system is such that it won't work. But interestingly, Switzerland, which is sort of like the mother of all referendum countries, they have the same mechanism. I believe that there was even some sort of cross-pollinization at the time of federation, and looking at this the Swiss model. So in Switzerland, pretty much, 90% of all referendums pass. And there are probably two reasons for that. The one reason is that in Switzerland, when they have a constitutional change, it is all the parties behind it. They talk about the overlapping consensus. So you can't change the offside rule if only one side wants to do that. So there is that overlapping consensus thing in Switzerland, which means they get it over the line. And then the other thing, which some people get quite upset when I say, is that you have, whenever you have compulsory voting, that tends to, compulsory voting is good for the left when it comes to elections. It's bad for the left when it comes to referendums. So a lot of people who are not interested in politics tend to vote no. So the support for anything is basically correlated with the interest in politics. So a lot of people who are not interested in politics have to turn out, and then they become sort of slightly spiteful and grumpy, and they say, oh, bugger it, I'm just going to vote no.
And that kind of makes sense. Like, if you actually think about the questions that Labor has put over the years, introducing national identity card, which goes to basically the efficiency and centralization of government, in 46, basically allowing the federal government to kind of get more involved in the social welfare space, taking on powers of the states. I've forgotten what the Whitlam era ones were.
That was the one that got up. That was the successful one.
Yeah, that's right. Okay, yeah. So being able to set prices and incomes, right, which was a power that I think existed in many European states, but which never happened here, for good or ill. These are all quite dramatic shifts of power or reorganizations of how power functions in our polity. And so, yeah, you can kind of see that they are far more kind of radical, and it would actually intuitively make sense that you would get that phenomena around the sort of voting behavior. A question I do have for you, Matt, and I really would like to know this, is one of the other things I've heard is that, and you've sort of alluded to this a little bit, which is that Australia has one of the most difficult referendum burdens globally. Is that actually true?
I wouldn't say so necessarily. Actually, it's probably on the sort of softer side in a way. You have Canada, for example, which is a large federal state with a large English-speaking population and all the rest of it.
Comparable to Australia, in
most ways, really. Mm. And in Canada, you don't just need a majority of the provinces. You need unanimity among the provinces and a majority.
Oh,
So if Quebec typically would vote against things, then it just doesn't go anywhere. So
maybe I've got sort of conceptual problems with the maths here, but if you've got if you've got unanimity in the provinces, that is, they all vote in favour, then you've got a majority anyway.
Then you're fine. But the problem is the other way around.
Yeah.
You sometimes have had,
you could get to a majority and just not, and one small state could be an outlier
and it
fails.
Yes, in fact, in one particular case in Canada, you don't need to have referendums, but the proposal for a constitutional change in 1987 was blocked by a filibuster in Manitoba. One person blocked the whole thing.
Mm.
I mean, that's a veto player if ever there was one.
Mm.
And if you take many other countries, I mean, some countries it's easy, like Ireland, where there's typically bipartisan support. You just need a majority of the votes and then it goes through. Some other European countries, Switzerland we've already mentioned, they also, you have to have a majority of those voting, and there are all sorts of shenanigans, really, that you can have.
And the logic of these is essentially, I suppose, there's a common rationale, at least, even if the formulas they've hit upon aren't necessarily all the same. But the rationale is essentially the constitution is fixed. It has a sort of an institutional inertia about it. If you need to shift something in it, you need to have more than just simply a majority. It can't be just this kind of fluky thing. It needs to be a very decisive largely consensus-driven approach. And whether you do it with the double hurdle that we have, or you do it with the way they've done it in Canada or some of these other places where they might have a super majority required, 75% or 60% or whatever it might be, it's sort of a common logic, right?
The technical term is entrenchment, and you want to make sure that the rules of the game are not sort of done in a gerrymandered sort of way.
So whoever just happened to win can just kind of...
So for example, in Germany, they don't have referendums because you said I focused on democratic countries. I've also written referendums in non-democratic places, Ayatollah Khomeini and Napoleon and Hitler. And they all had what I call plebiscites. And Germany has...
Like the Anschluss was one of those, wasn't it?
Anschluss was one of them. They also...
Which was for the annexation of Austria.
Yes. Yeah. And there's a wonderful entry in Goebbels' diary where he's very concerned they haven't rigged the vote, so we can't trust these people. And then he's biting his nails. And Goebbels, yes. And then Goebbels the following day says, oh, great, we didn't even need to rig it because the Austrians went along with it. So there's a little bit of it's a sensitive issue in Germany to have referendums at a national level. But there, arguably, the hurdle is more difficult because the two largest parties have to support the changes. So you can't have the sort of Australian situation. So probably for good reason, it is reasonable that the constitution is a thing that everybody agrees on. And when the constitution becomes the political football, then that becomes problematic.
Yeah, that's true. But at the same time, whatever you do, to an extent, it can be gamed, or there can be perverse outcomes. And I suppose, like it's reasonably well known that in 1999, John Howard had effectively kind of three media statements ready on the night.
Yes,
because that was the Republic referendum. What was different about it, or what was deadly to it, really, in terms of its chances, was that there wasn't unanimity, political kind of bipartisanship around it, and also the putting party, if I can put it like that, the party that put the referendum was the no side. That is, the government of the day was the no side. Nonetheless, that Republican push started out, from my majority position.
Yes.
Howard didn't know, and no one, just like we don't know now, no one knew exactly what the outcome was. So he had win, lose, and the middle position, which was that a majority of Australians vote for the Republic, but it doesn't make the second hurdle. It doesn't get the four states. Because that would have been quite difficult for him as well, even though it would have meant the defeat of the referendum question, but it would have put the government at odds with the majority of Australian citizens, and he needed to have a way of explaining that.
Yes.
So it's when you look at it, the politics of these things can be quite tricky. Similarly, if you get a situation, and we could face this situation with this referendum we're having now, that we're about to have, where you could have a situation where you've got, quite a substantial majority and not get the four states because, for example, Queensland is widely expected by both sides to be a no vote. Mm-hmm. That's a pretty sizable chunk of the Australian population there. And New South Wales, there have been reports this week. I mean, the game's not over yet by any stretch, but there's been polling this week reported in the Nine newspapers that it's dipping behind. So you might end up with the small states like Tasmania and South Australia, perhaps even Western Australia and Victoria together mounting the four, but still not get to the 50% because of other things. There's all kinds of different formulas in this. And I guess that's the safety, behind it that you were talking about, the entrenchment, but it's also, it can frustrate the will of the people.
Yes, and that's what's one of the problems we have with referendums. They also build up momentum for one side that sort of feels that actually this campaign has sort of rejuvenated people. So in Scotland, for example, when we had the referendum in Britain, or in Scotland rather, about that, they started on 28% in support for Scottish independence, and then they crept up to 44%. So they arguably won the referendum campaign. Mm. And because they won the referendum campaign, they were then able to use that momentum to win literally all the seats in Scotland, the Scottish National Party was. So the relationship between a referendum and elections is one of the more interesting things, I think, because you sometimes can lose a referendum and create that momentum and this sort of feeling of camaraderie that on one side of politics. So referendums are these sort of monsters that politicians occasionally let out of the bag, and then they grow into things they cannot control.
They're quite interesting, Maria, in the from a political science point of view, because the ones we're talking about occur in what we call representative democracies, and yet they're a step outside of that. They're a step around the representatives for a direct participation in the decision-making process by the electors, and that's their attraction. They sort of feel hyper-democratic almost, and people think that's great. I mean, that's why, in a sense, the direct election argument was so salient for so many people in 1999, because those people were actually engaging in a referendum and thinking, well, there's a contradiction here. If we're engaging in a referendum and you're asking us to instill rules that will once again turn this into what they called pejoratively a politician's republic, with the parliament selecting the president. Their argument, and I think it was, as I say, a pretty salient argument for a lot of people, was, well, if we can do this, then we can do that. We can elect a president, and that's what we ought to be voting on. And if you're not giving us that model, we're not for it.
Yeah, I mean, if you think about it from like a democratic theory perspective, like typically what we're doing is, as voters, is electing agents, right, who act on our behalf.
Yeah.
But in the case of referenda, like the way they are constructed here, as opposed to, say, citizen-initiated referenda in Switzerland or in other jurisdictions, where the idea is that we should give citizens a greater say on specific issues or a whole bunch of issues, or allow them to basically put measures on the ballot. Like, we have quite a restricted sense of how questions can get up and how they can be put to a vote like that. But here it's basically like the Constitution is this fundamental kind of document, and that actually we don't trust agents to change it on our behalf, and that they must come to us as the people to receive this kind of affirmation. I mean, I think one of the things that is kind of interesting about the international literature on constitutional changes is that it's sort of what you, like, especially once you include all democracies, right? And so obviously you're going to get quite a range of what is a democracy, because that's actually a pretty loose term. And the data is quite clear, which is that the sort of harder it is to change the constitution, the more likely that the regime will actually fall over. And so people are doing it because of entrenchment, right? They're trying to entrench rules, they're trying to safeguard institutions. But if you don't have those ability, like all the norms that are attendant to these kinds of conversations, the ability to structure deals, to actually change fundamental rules about our governing system without resorting to arms, which is kind of what we're talking about here, it actually falls over. Which is, I suppose, something to kind of have in the back of our minds as this debate, which is actually getting very ugly, goes on. I think the other thing to remember about the referendum around the Republic is that the yes case was divided. And I think, I mean, like, without actually having any data, like, I think that is actually quite significant. It wasn't just that the government was against it, but that, you know, it was actually quite a close run thing. And if the yes case was more united, it's conceivable that it would have gotten over the line.
It's funny, actually, when you think about it in terms of the sort of political logic at the time, the reasoning for having this minimalist change, essentially replacing the governor general with a president, and leaving the machinery, except for a few titles and so forth, essentially the same. The logic of that was incremental change will frighten the voters less. We want to preserve as much of the system we've got, but make it fully self-contained as an Australian exercise. That's a sort of a reasonably solid piece of logic, and yet it was its incrementalism in the end, which a lot of people, the direct electionists, felt was its key weakness. And there's a little bit of an echo of in that Lydia Thorpe's position on The Voice,
the
actually.
The black sovereignty kind of movement, or people who are advocating for the, I suppose, you know, truth, treaty, voice, that specific ordering, which, you know, is, I think, a perfectly reasonable and valid set of arguments.
As long as you come up with some sort of at least vaguely credible pathway to get there, and no one has.
No.
Certainly not Lydia Thorpe.
I mean, the other kind of important major distinction between this and a republic is that, you know, a republic is an issue that very much, I think, was tied to effectively the dominant white Australia, something that the whole elite was kind of engaged with, whereas the voice is doesn't have the same level of engagement across the community or even across our political elites, which is reflected in the sort of absurd positions from the coalition around not having enough detail when they've literally been the government for 10 years promising recognition, like, you know, essentially managing and engaging the process of engaging with Indigenous people who have been advocating for this and like literally created most of the documentation that underwrites this model.
Not to mention the fact that they say simultaneously they're opposed to a, quote, Canberra voice, when in fact their proposal is for a legislated voice.
Canberra voice. Like,
I mean, it's just no one ever seems to, on their side, ever seems to have to explain that. You've been listening to Dr. Maria Taflaga and Professor Matt Quatrop, from Coventry University, a visiting fellow here at Australian National University. He's the author and editor of several books, one of which I have in front of me, Complementary Democracy, The Art of Deliberative Listening, which is a new book, is it, Matt?
Yes, it is.
And you've also been the editor of a book quite pertinent to our discussion here today, Referendums Around the World. Let's just take a quick break and we'll be back in a moment.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
When the wind veered, the smoke was driven backwards, revealing a most amazing scene. Standing columns of fire.
To Be Continued is a new podcast that explores the rich world of lost literary fiction from Australia's past.
It helps you to understand the way in which knowledge is kind of not something that's out there waiting to be discovered, but it's something that you create.
To Be Continued is brought to you by the Australian National University and is available now on your favourite podcast app.
Welcome back. Matt Quatrop, I've got to get your name right.
I can't pronounce my own name.
Can't you?
No.
I'm glad to hear
but
that.
But the Spectator once wrote a review of one of my books and they say he sounds more like the first line on the keyboard, but thankfully he makes more sense. I don't know if I do the latter, but I do sound the first line on the keyboard.
It is an unusual spelling, I think, isn't it? So Q-V-O-R-T-U-R-P.
T-R-U-P. Yes, it's Frisian, actually. So northern Germany, Netherlands, that sort of thing.
Thanks for clearing that up. I'll try to pronounce it correctly.
Well, I can't pronounce it myself, so you can do anything you like, frankly. That's pretty easy, though.
I'm appalled with myself, put it that way. Let's go back to the substance of this discussion. Again, a fairly broad question. Are referendums on the rise around the world?
Yes, they are. I mean, it's not sort of like as if they're thundering away, but the more populism that you have, the more politicians feel that they are sort of under threat from elites. They have this tendency to kick things out into the long grass, or it's sometimes even referred to in the literature as too hot to handle. Right. So you have issues that are divided.
So is this like wicked problems that we sometimes hear referred to, or is it?
Well, it's like, you know, marriage equality, for example, or gay marriage, whatever we choose to call it. It is an issue that's not necessarily, you know, sort of party political.
Yeah, it doesn't fit that taxonomy.
And in some ways, it's a good thing that you can have your cake and eat it. You know, political parties may have a position. It's perfectly possible to say in Britain, for example, to be in favour of Brexit and still be in favour of a party that is on the left. And you can have issues on sort of social conservative issues, and even be be conservative on say lifestyle choices, and so in a way referendums allows you that luxury, if you like, of voting you know, contrary to what you normally have. But the slight contradiction is actually that in roughly 80% of the cases, people take the cues from the parties they normally support.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And
yeah.
And so if you have, and I'm speaking quite hypothetically and not an expert on your country, if you have a leader of the opposition who's, you know, personal approval ratings aren't great, and if he swings in favor of a particular thing, that might actually harm the cause. So people will normally say, well, if he's in favor of it, I couldn't possibly vote for this. So it's quite dangerous, and I'm speaking in a hypothetical sort of way.
Absolutely hypothetical. Yes. Absolutely. Yeah.
And so you could, you know, if you sort of, you know, and you may not necessarily identify with a, you know, property owning person who is a policeman in Queensland, hypothetically speaking.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you think about it, referendums are a useful way for parties to resolve intractable problems that they have within their own ranks by essentially relaxing the rules of discipline and outsourcing the problem, right?
Yes.
And then they don't have to come to a compromise. They don't have to come to a resolution. They can simply, you know, defer it. And that's exactly what the coalition did with the marriage equality plebiscite. Right.
Postal survey, yes.
Yes, that's right. The postal survey, yes, that's right. That was the correct term. Because they couldn't come to a position that was internally stable, and also there were certain actors who clearly believed that that plebiscite would fail and were shocked when it didn't.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was a pragmatic solution. And we actually kind of see this with the deliberative processes in Ireland around abortion and gay marriage in particular. And in the United States, instead of it kind of going to referenda, though, you know, you do sort of see that at the state level with, like, you know, rules around not increasing taxes, which is a crazy thing to do, but things like that. But, you know, it actually all gets deferred to the courts. So these are all mechanisms for legislators to basically cop out of their jobs.
A really good example of what you've both been talking about there was the example you cited, the same-sex marriage survey, because some of the highest no votes around the country were in Labor electorates, you know, and sort of the safest Labor seats tended to have, particularly in Western Sydney and some of those sort of places, tended to have the greatest resistance to that social change. So that was a good example of an issue that Labor broadly as a parliamentary party was lined up on, but its base perhaps had a different view, and it enabled, it would have enabled, had Labor been in, it certainly enabled Labor in an opposition position to prosecute a case without taking on its own constituents. Yes.
And I think just when you mentioned America, it's interesting in America where they have the initiative where people can sign a petition, then they have a referendum.
This is like in California.
And in literally half of the US states, they have this provision. And in many states, people will vote, like, Florida, for example. DeSantis is a fairly conservative guy.
Fairly, yeah.
Yes. But one of the things he was opposed to was to give rights to ex-offenders, so because they're more likely to vote for the Democrats. So there was a referendum on that. People voted for giving them this right, but they also vote for DeSantis. So people can say, well, I can have an opinion on a thing which is more progressive than that, but I still, so people are allowed to and are able to do opposite things, which, you know, in some ways is good for democracy.
Well, I think so. I mean, it's a level of articulation that ought to be within the system. That people should be able to make decisions on the basis of the issue, not just on the basis of their particular loyalty to a candidate or party. And if they have a different position, then the referendum or the citizens initiated process allows them to do that. Let's talk about some of the other myths. We started off talking about, you know, the double majority and how that's sometimes described and misunderstood by some people. There's a lot of talk in this country at the moment about where the yes case is on the voice to parliament. The polling showing the yes support dropping. Some people suggesting, quite a few people actually, and some reasonably influential people suggesting the government should consider delaying the actual referendum because you only get one shot at this, at least in sort of, you know, any foreseeable future. If it goes down now, it won't be back, possibly. Mm-hmm. Won't be back, you know. Certainly not in the short term. What do we know about that? I mean, can the campaign hasn't formally started yet, the Yes campaign, frustratingly so. But, you know, for those of us who would like to see the Yes campaign develop a bit of energy and a bit of focus, but nonetheless, That's one of the arguments, one of the excuses that's put forward, that the Yes campaign hasn't started yet. Should we take anything really this far out from the referendum about where it is? Are the positions locked in, or how can it move around?
Now, people can change their minds, and they tend to do that quite a lot. I mean, the general rule of thumb, which indicates that maybe somebody in positions of influence might have read one of my books, is that the shorter the campaign is, the more likely you are to win. So far, so good. The other thing that seems to be where people may not have read my book is, and of course that's a travesty, but hey-ho.
Yeah.
There are still some people out there.
Yeah, there's still some people out there, and maybe after this they might change their mind. Mm. But the other myth is that when you fall behind in the polls, then that's curtains, and you know, and there's no recovering whatsoever. That just simply is not the case. We saw during the Brexit campaign in Britain that Brexit sort of at some stage went ahead, and then they fell behind, and people were saying, oh, then it's fine, we don't need to worry about it, and then they come back again. In Ireland, when they had the one you mentioned before about the gay marriage, they were on 73% when they started, then they dipped way into the 50s, and people say, oh, no, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, because you assume then this is a Catholic country, very conservative, that the support has waned, and that's that, right?
Yeah, and then they come back, and actually they won it at the end, and they went up again, so there was a dip, and then they went up. And then the other myth,
and they went up because of the campaign period itself,
in the campaign period itself, and also, you know, it wasn't going to be that radical, and people actually sort of started thinking about this in a way, and maybe the argument actually came across a little bit better, and so on. So this idea that once you fall behind in the polls, it's curtains is just not the case. We've seen in several referendums in recent years, not just in Britain, but in Scandinavian countries, for example, where there is a lead for one side, then they fall behind, and then they sort of crawl back again. And we often have this sort of slightly sort of V-shaped kind of tendency in referendums. They were sort of a V-shape with a higher up on one side. So that's one of the things. The other thing is that they often say that in doubt, vote no, and all the no vote or the don't knows tend to fall disproportionately for the no side. In several referendums, that's not the case. I mean, in the Irish one I mentioned, 2/3 of the don't knows went to the yes side. And often,
can I take you back to your earlier point yes, though, about compulsory voting not being a friend of the reform side, because people who have to go to the polling booth might resent it, and they haven't really engaged with the question, and therefore they have a sort of a default position of no.
Mm.
That's in a sense what if you don't know, vote no is appealing to, isn't it? That kind of sentiment.
It is.
Sort of almost making it an honourable position to be a non-citizen.
Yes, and there is a lot of, I think in Australia is one of the few countries where you do have compulsory voting, of course. But if you look at across the board and other countries where you have compulsory voting, they have a tendency in those, and of course statistics is just statistics, but as a general rule, compulsory voting takes away 6% from whatever lead you might have. So you need an extra 6% of lead in countries with compulsory voting, and that's quite a bit of a hurdle. If you don't have bipartisan support, you need another 10%. So you're starting with a deficit of 16% effectively, and that makes it rather difficult to win. But that said,
it's not over yet. And it should be said here too, just for the sake of completeness, that you don't have to get 50% plus one. You just have to get more than the no's.
Yes.
Right? There will be probably some informals. It may be that 48% is more than the 46% that the no case gets in a particular jurisdiction, and that becomes a yes vote, at least for that state.
And I think another myth that is often sort of bandied about is the idea of sort of the negative campaigning, scare campaigning.
Mm.
A lot of scare campaigns have worked in elections, because then you're trying to find somebody to represent you. And that's your point before about, you know, your agents and your
representatives.
Yes, representatives. Yes, yeah. Because somebody represents you. Mm. So if I am finding a solicitor or an accountant, I want somebody I can trust with my money or my legal affairs and so on. So there, and I say this is a dodgy person, but the thing about referendums don't cheat on their taxes or their wives or husbands or whatever the case may be.
Mm.
So all those are the personalized campaigns. don't work in referendums. And negative campaigning is one of the things that people can see through. We've had, I think there was a Dutch referendum that I was, where I was in 2005. And they say, well, the European Union has kept us together. We hadn't had wars. And, you know, and then the implication was, you know, if you don't vote yes for the European constitution, Hitler would be back or something like that. And they went sort of completely into overdrive about this, all this negativity. And the Dutch voters sort of thought, well, wait a minute, actually, we were skeptical before, but if that's the kind of
argument.
Yeah. Then so scare campaigns, and again, perhaps hypothetically speaking, on one side particularly more than the other, don't really work in referendums, because you can take the issue and then, you know, weigh up whether it's a good or a bad idea. So if you have relatively simple facts presented by people who are non-divisive and you can sort of, you know, relate to, then you can win a referendum. If you resort to scare campaigns and sort of go up into sort of falsetto kind of level, then that's,
well, there's not a fair bit of that going on. I'll name it. Right, there's a fair bit of it going on the no side.
Yes,
there's less of it going on the yes side. But in fact, there's less of a lot of things going on the yes side, including clear messaging, from what I can tell. And maybe that is to come. Presumably, one hopes. But nonetheless, it's an interesting point about that, you know, what works and what doesn't. What about celebrities having prominent people involved? Because there's been some stories that, you know, everyone from Sam Kerr and Ash Barty and a number of others were kind of lined up to sort of feature in the Yes campaign, and that may have been walked away from, and it'll be much more sort of ordinary people fronting the Yes case. Yes. What's the evidence of the role of celebrities?
Yeah, it's one of my favourite things, because I can do my David Beckham impersonation, you know, and David Beckham thought it would be a bad idea to vote for Brexit. East London is actually where I come from, so I'm allowed to do that. Yes. You know, you just open your mouth and halfway through there, like that. So David Beckham came out against Brexit, and people said, well, Bendit like Beckham is okay and his free kicks are fine. But what does that actually say about him as a, you know, he doesn't necessarily go through just through monetary policy issues about whatever the case may be.
Yeah.
Stephen Hawkins came out against Brexit. Andy Murray came out, and I won't do a Scottish accent, for Scottish independence. And the only thing that happened was that he was booed.
At Wimbledon?
At Wimbledon, because that's in
Brexit, a bunch of toffs.
Booing a Scot. Why would you do that? Yeah.
Apparently champion for some time.
And then he hasn't won ever since. But then again, maybe he was useless, you know. But I think my favorite example of that, and I was sort of, was in 2003 in Sweden, when they had their referendum on the euro. And they, on the yes side, that was Carl Bildt, who was a very sensible sort of conservative prime minister and later diplomat. And I was talking to him, and he was sort of very triumphant. He says, now we've got it in the bag, because the two guys from ABBA, Bjorn and Benny, have come out in favor of having the euro. And he even sort of cracked the joke of money, 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 in the sort of Swedish accent. Yeah. And I said, well, you can't assume to take winner takes it all. And we sort of joked a little bit about it. And the no side said, well, of course, everybody likes Bjorn and Benny as much as the next person. But what about my mortgage? And then they had a picture of a sort of an ordinary Swedish housewife. It turned out she was a model, but she played that role.
That's Sweden.
Mm. And then she just basically, you know, my mortgage ? And that was the only thing they needed to do. So this idea that you have celebrities and celebrities work just on several levels doesn't work.
Well, it's interesting. I wonder if this question is
actually qualitatively different from, like, many of the technical, financial and complex decision streams that come from this. And you know, I actually do think that The Voice does have lots of potential implications. And I mean that positively, right? Mm. Because it is quite an open-ended proposal, essentially giving the parliament a great deal of scope to be creative with The Voice over decades and generations, and basically to keep it relevant. And that's a good thing. But it is actually ultimately really a moral question. You know, like, do you think that Indigenous people should have the right to essentially advocate for themselves in a structured way that can't be taken away? And I do wonder if that is slightly more able to have celebrity appeal, but not like I'm a celebrity, therefore I'm correct. But, you know, I'm an Australian like you, one that you know, and I feel that this is the right thing to do. I wonder if that's what makes this potentially different as a proposition. Yes, yes.
I mean, one of the things, sometimes when we sort of look at democracy, there was a manual for winning elections in Greece way back 2,400 years ago. And it was said, in order to win a campaign or win an argument, you need to be a credible person that people will listen to. You need to have a rational argument that leads from A to B, and then you have to have passion. And if you take, for example, the no side, I mean, the no side is many things. We've got, you know, Thorpe on the sort of one side of the argument. Then we've got people who are ill-disguised.
It's a complete contradiction. Yes. Thorpe says it doesn't do anything, and the other side says it does too much.
And as long as they can keep those people apart. But then you have Warren Mundine, I think I'm pronouncing his name correctly, who is a soft-spoken Aboriginal man himself. So he's got the credibility, again, from an outside position and only seeing him on the drum and things like that. He sort of seems to be, you know, he can be also painted into a corner. He may lose his entire career as a result of this. But I think the if you were to find, say, an Aboriginal, there was a guy who made a documentary who was sort of called out, and he was he played for Sydney Swans.
Adam Goods.
You know, he's sort of like, he's an articulate, intelligent man, and he's somebody who would have the authority and the credibility. And if he can then make a rational argument saying, this directly links to, you know, terrible things that are happening in Alice Springs, and then he has the passion. That's the winning formula. So literally, what did the Greeks ever do for us? They showed us how to win campaigns. So maybe instead of reading my books, they could read sort of ancient campaign literature from Greece.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is sort of frustrating that the Yes campaign, I guess, has only really just started getting going. And I mean, like, they're already organising on the ground, and it does look like that this campaign will be run at two levels. And from the reporporting, it seems like the Yes campaign, like, they're not necessarily all on the same page within that organisation, right? Yeah. And so there's clearly some organisational dimensions there. But we are kind of waiting for, I suppose, you know, this sort of volunteer machine to go and knock on doors, and for Labor. Well,
there's a fair
bit
of that happening. I think it's fair to say there's a fair bit of campaigning going on, and the sort of door knock
thing.
That's
what's happening in my electorate, yeah.
Yeah, and that can be quite persuasive, but of course it's hard grind. It's a slow process, involves a lot of effort, but it may well be effort that turns out to be decisive in a number of places. But I think the other thing that the Yes campaign suffers from, and it doesn't mean that it will suffer from this all the way to the end. I'm not saying that, because we haven't seen exactly what form it's going to take. But there's been this sort of sense, and this is its kind of, you know, put as its kind of moral superiority, that it's a community-driven campaign, that it's driven by First Nations peoples and by the community generally. It's not the government doing it. It's not a political campaign in that kind of party divisive sense. But the downside of all of those what sound like virtues is that it doesn't feel like it's got any actual focus, like any purpose, any key figures that are prominent and that around which the campaign, or from which the campaign seems to derive, and that lack of focus, I think, at the moment, makes it look sort of fairly disorganized, fairly piecemeal, fairly. Now, that may change, of course, or it may end up being, and I think this is a concern, it may end up being Labor's defense when it doesn't get up, if it doesn't get up. And Labor says, well, you know, and there's a history of this sort of logic, I think, Matt, where governments, it goes back to this idea of sort of kicking it into the long grass, the government might say, well, we declared we would do it. We said from the get-go we would honour the Uluru Statement from the heart. We've gone about that. We've put the legislation through Parliament to enable this referendum, and we've handed it to the community, and the community has made a judgment on it, and therefore we've lost no skin on it.
I think there's, like, you know, this idea from the right that this will, like, destroy the prime ministership is fanciful, but it is damaging to Albanese's prestige because he didn't have to make this personal commitment. And he's made a personal commitment to do that. He did that on election night, you know, in effect. And
it was to, I think the word was deliver the Uluru statement.
Yeah, I mean, even if to hold a referendum, like, I mean, in some ways, like, I think we shouldn't get too caught up in words like deliver or hold, whatever. But, you know,
you've got to stand behind it.
I agree. I mean, I think, no, absolutely. And I think that it will reflect badly on the government, but I don't think it will have I don't think it will destroy the Prime Minister's prime ministership, which is an argument being sort of made in some circles on the right, and why, you know, what Dutton is doing is such a brilliant idea. I agree with Matt that I think voters will actually distinguish between this issue and the sort of bread and butter politics, basically economic voting, which most elections kind of turn on, and all that the coalition might succeed in doing is consolidating their vote in Queensland, which they already own.
Well, that's true. But going back to Matt's point before about, you know, celebrities and a kind of a dimension of that is going back to that Swedish example of the, you know, but what about my mortgage or whatever it was? That kind of debate is happening in Australia already, that the opposition is saying the government's consumed with talking about The Voice. And meanwhile, we're in a cost of living crisis. Interest rates have, you know, gone up at a record rate, if not to anywhere near record highs. And, you know, gas prices, electricity prices, lots of other costs of living have gone up. People are suffering and the government's kind of consumed with a distraction, kind of a cultural issue. That is the subtext of Dutton's kind
that's not
of
even
attack.
Subtext. I mean, they're talking about The Voice more than anyone. It's got nothing else to say.
And I think people are more – I mean, the Australian electorate is also relatively sophisticated. I mean, in most democratic countries, people are more sophisticated than that. And if you are relatively new opposition and you're blaming the – I mean, I think the first rule in government is when you get into power, make a list of all the crimes you need to commit and do them immediately. And that's and you need to do that because you can blame the previous lot. Mm. And the previous lot here have robo-debt and a number of things that people very much have not forgotten about. Mm. So when somebody comes out and says, we should be more focused on prices and cost of living, then they say, well, you had 10 years to do that. Why didn't you? So it's a very dangerous thing to do. And I think also the other thing is that
not so sure. I mean, I think media, generally speaking, are kind of aping some of these arguments.
I mean, probably, but then a different fact, if you like, from it is that
that's an alternative fact. We like to deal with alternative facts.
No, I'm a different take on the world of referendums is that it's very rare for politicians to resign after referendum defeats. I looked at
Cameron did,
and Alex Salmond did, but you'd be hard pressed to find anybody else who did. I mean, Mitterrand didn't resign Chirac didn't resign.
I don't think there's any chance of that happening here either. But I do think it's
Dutton. And often actually people tend to win elections. I mean, Hawke won election. Both after that, the Liberals kept winning after they had the most massive defeat with the Communist one. So losing a referendum is
yeah, but the Labour Party splitting apart in the mid-50s didn't do it.
But they split apart in the mid-50s because they had to pander to people who were seen as unpalatable to the middle ground. So I think Dutton is doing an effort sort of in reverse. He's having to pander to people who are unpalatable to people who live on, say, the northern
voter,
beaches.
Basically.
That's an interesting idea. So, but I also think, we'll see how this pans out, but he was in an extremely weak position, you know, having lost all these key seats, his party having lost all these key seats of the election, totally weakened. He's taken up this kind of highly abrasive or sort of, you know, conflictual approach a la Tony Abbott. Mm. And The Voice and defeating The Voice are kind of a signature reform that the Prime Minister personalised on election night. Mm. Is a way of pegging back the Prime Minister.
I think there's something more complicated going on here. Like, Dutton's position nationally, according to all the polling evidence, is quite weak, but internally it's quite strong.
Yeah, because it's about unity.
Well, precisely. I mean, like, I keep hearing this line, like, oh, the first job of an opposition is to keep the party, the show, united. Where is there potentials for splits in what is a reduced party room now. Realistically, where are the fissure lines? They're not really there. This is actually a show that is quite easy to keep together compared to what it was like in 1983 or even in 2007-8, right?
Yeah, because the voters took part of the progressive wing at the last election.
They basically took that bit off. Yeah. And so the party room, like actually maintaining that, this is, I think this is, for Dutton, this is actually not about keeping the show together, but about energizing the people that he has.
Well, that's sort of what I'm arguing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, no.
And we'll see how that plays out.
But the campaign is becoming more, their campaign and arguments are becoming more incoherent and more distasteful. And it's a cul-de-sac. It's a lovely cul-de-sac. Mm. But how do they actually drive out of it? Like after the referendum, if it fails, right? It's actually very easy for everyone to blame Dutton for it. I don't see how that actually helps him. And even, okay, so there's a segment of voters out there who might be unhappy or persuaded that the government isn't focusing on the cost of living, which I think is a difficult argument to mount, given that's pretty much like 80% of what they talk about all the time. And just the sheer volume of information, even if you're not paying attention, it's about the cost of living and the Treasurer talking about the cost of living and not about the voice. So I think that's just difficult position for them to maintain.
Well,
that kind
might
of
be
a strategy is a long-term strategy because you've got to actually persuade these people to vote for you on economic concerns at the next election. People are not going to vote no on this referendum, which is, if you think about it, framed in two ways. It's a weedy constitutional question for eggheads, or it's, you know, a moral question, or simply one about how you feel about Indigenous people and if you are essentially, you know, pro doing something for them or not. These are for, you know, like to actually use the logic of Dutton, like, you know, eighth order issues. They don't decide national elections. I just, you know, like I understand why he has structurally pursued this, because it serves his immediate goals and it certainly helped to galvanize his party after the Aston by-election, which was certainly not a great time for him. But I don't actually see how this translates into forward momentum beyond taking a bit of paint off Albanese.
Well, taking a bit of paint off Albanese may be the game, because very few opposition leaders who take over after an election loss, you know, that is when they've been in government, end up being prime minister. Some of them don't end up even getting to contest the election. So that's why there's this sort of focus
on
the party room, keep the peloton tight. And
That's fair. But like, okay, Albanese stood up for something he believed in and he took a risk and gambled and lost. What's the problem with that? How does that make him a bad man that you can't trust?
Well, I'm not arguing.
Do you know what I mean?
But
I think if I can use a cricket metaphor, which I'm not necessarily keen on at the moment, but it's sort of like, you know, you can stay in, but you need to make runs. And I think he's staying in, and that's the party room, but he's not necessarily getting any runs. And you need to get runs on the board to win elections, and you need to appeal to the median voter. And I think if I can just slightly on the referendum, what you need to do in order to win a referendum is you need to frame it in a very simple way. 1967 is often mentioned because that was like the moment when Australia stood up. And in the referendum literature around the world, that sort of like, it always sort of stands out, like the only country to ever vote on Aboriginal rights was Australia, and they delivered, you know. And it's sort of like it should be a matter of pride. Actually, that was about very technical detail
It's still misunderstood.
States. Yes. Mm. But it's sort of like the you encourage people in that particular delusion. And what I think the way it could be framed here is that this is a relatively technical thing, but it's one that would once again paint Australia as the progressive country. Mm. And most of the people who were in sort of the teal-like seats would probably say, well, we want a bit of social conservatism, but we want to be progressive on racial issues.
Yeah.
So this allows Australia in a way to... So in Britain, of course, we currently have a Muslim mayor of London and a Hindu prime minister, and we sort of made good on what was seen as being sort of inward-looking Britain. Now Australia can become the leader in the English-speaking world of being progressive and friendly and nice and deal with their history. Mm. And so that, I think, would be the way to deal with that.
I agree. I think, but those arguments need to be put. You know, it takes a certain amount of courage.
I'm just offering a bit of free advice here. Yes.
I think it takes a certain amount of national courage to square up to your own history and to be and to build forward from that. And that's really the opportunity the country has here, right, to actually accept the way colonization happened, all of the crimes, all of the dispossession, all of the horror of it, and all of the intergenerational sequelae from those events, and to step forward in partnership. That's what the Uluru Statement offers.
Yes.
And I think enlightened Australia, for the most part, recognises that. Some others have not even engaged with it yet and will support it when they do, and some others won't. Now, I just want to finish on, and it's a bit of a segue, but I think a pretty neat one in this context. In British politics, which you're very familiar with, that has been a roller coaster ride of sort of crises, really, that stem from the aforementioned Brexit referendum, really.
Yes.
Which, as you just noted before, fairly short order led to the resignation of the Prime Minister, David Cameron, and a whole lot of ructions and weird events that have happened since. Is British politics now stabilised under Rishi Sunak, and where are the Tories? Sort of, where are they standing now in terms of any chance of surviving?
Well, I think it's important that you put it like the Tory party's survival. I mean, they're adults in the room again, which is helpful.
Yeah.
And it was sort of moving into sort of like pre-kindergarten stage under Liz Truss and Boris. I don't even know where we can start. So with Rishi Sunak, it's sort of competence is back in charge. What he will be able to do if he's successful in steadying the ship, what it's all about, is to avoid the annihilation of the Conservative Party. I mean, they were looking for that. They're 20 to 28% behind in the polls. Mm. They recently won a by-election on a local issue, but they lost another one. So, and in a way, that was the worst thing that could happen for the Conservative Party, because now they think they might actually do better. What they would have really would be good for them would have been a sort of like a defeat all around. What Sunak is trying to do is saving the Conservative Party from annihilation.
So this is save the furniture sort of for Prime Minister.
Yes, yeah. And he will lose that, and he will go down probably like John Major did back in the day, not to a catastrophic defeat. Major went down to a fairly catastrophic defeat, but at least the Conservative Party survived, having ruined the economy. So they in sort of British history, there's whenever you sort of mess up the economy, and you're seen to get the blame for that. 1992, we had the Black Wednesday, which John Major was probably not responsible for, was blamed for, Gordon Brown. And once you lose that sort of competency, which they did under Liz Truss, it's impossible really to come back. But he can minimise the damage. But for the Conservatives to win the next election, frankly, would be for the birds.
Very interesting. Professor Matt Quartrup, thanks for being on Democracy Sausage. It's been great to have you around. And you're around at ANU for a while yet, I think, till a referendum.
Until, I was about to say, it ain't over till the whoever sings. Yes. So,
we'll have to talk to you again. I look
forward
to it.
Yes. And I did predict Brexit, I should say, with some mathematical model, but I don't think the same thing applies necessarily here. I think it's still all to play for. And it's got to be enthralling.
Yeah. Maria, thanks
again. Thank you. And bye, everyone.
Well, just before we say bye, I need to make a community service announcement. If you are interested in learning more about the referendum, the Australian National University is hosting a dialogue on The Voice in Canberra next week. So I suppose this is a message for those of our listeners who live in the capital. I'll actually be hosting this discussion next week, and I'll be joined by a number of really important people, including Professor Megan Davis, who was one of the architects of the Uluru Statement, co-chair of the Uluru Statement from the Heart, Labor Senator Yana Stewart, and Liberal Senator Andrew Bragg, who is a supporter of the referendum, but who has recently been one of those people who's talked about... He's complained that he thinks the government hasn't done enough to build consensus across the middle, and he's a thoughtful thoughtful guy, and he's also floated the idea of perhaps this should be delayed rather than lost, if that's what the evidence is suggesting at the moment, but. Of course, we don't know whether that's the case or not. Anyway, it's going to be taking place at 5 p.m. on Wednesday, the 2nd of August, at the Llewellyn Hall on the campus of ANU. So if you're interested in joining us, you can register via the link in the episode description, and we'd really like to have you come along. It's going to be a really good event, and students will have a chance to ask questions, to get more information. It's very much an information gathering forum rather than, you know, than a political debate forum per se, but there'll be some interesting and divergent views from the panel, and I'm looking forward to chairing that. It's a great honour, and hopefully we'll see you there if you're in Canberra or the local region. That is Democracy Sausage for this week. Thanks again for being with us.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.